I was glad when they said to me, "Let us go into the house of the Lord." Our feet have been standing within your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem is built as a city that is compact together. Where the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, to the testimony of Israel. They give thanks to the name of the Lord, for thrones are set there for judgment, the thrones of the house of David. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they prosper who love her. Peace be within your walls, prosperity within your palaces. For the sake of my brethren and companions, I will now say, peace be within you. Because of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good. I can't think of a more timely petition to the Lord than this one here in Psalm 122. The Lord inspires David to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. A few weeks ago, a lady in our community called me late one night. She doesn't go to our church. We've been praying for her and her husband. They're both unbelievers, but she asked me with a very deep concern after watching the evening news, as we watch that every night and see the horror scenes in the Middle East. So, Chris, where did this all originate? Where did the Jews come from? Where did the Arabs come from? Why can't they get along? Why is there hostility on a never-ending basis in the Middle East? Well, I tried my best to answer her question in a few minutes. I probably did a terrible job, because that answer, it takes a lifetime to answer. But this morning, what I want to do in the brief moments I have with you is to talk about the root causes of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, I realize that what I'm going to speak on this morning is more apropos for a Sunday school or a Bible study setting. I wish I had maps up here and charts and diagrams, things like that, but I don't. And so it kind of lends itself more for a Q&A session afterwards. So I'm going to make the best of what I'm going to do this morning, and I probably will not get finished. And so next year when you invite me, I'll just continue where I left off. Because I rest assured that I'll probably be still going over in the Middle East, the conflict. What I want to do this morning, touch upon four key items. And very briefly, I cannot do justice to any one of these four. The first one is this. Where did the Arabs and the Jews come from? What were their beginnings, their origins? The second part. When did Islam begin? You cannot understand the Middle East unless you understand the religion of Islam. Thirdly, what is modern Middle East history? A lot of people may be surprised to know that all the countries in the Middle East, most of them, are of recent origin. They were carved up after World War I and World War II. So what exactly is the status over there of the countries surrounding Israel? If you can picture a map of the United States, take Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, all the way to California, Oregon. Take that big chunk of America. Place right in the middle of that geographical area the state of New Jersey or Massachusetts. You have a pretty good picture of Israel surrounded by Arabic countries. We're talking about a very small sliver of land in the Middle East that's called today Israel, which was founded in 1948 as a modern nation. And so after I look at that third aspect of the status of Middle East history, I want to make some concluding remarks. When I was growing up, my parents told me, as we went down to Texas to see a favorite aunt and uncle of mine, that, now, Chris, when we go down there, I remember going down on I-35 one time, we don't talk religion and politics with Buddy and Irene. We love them dearly, they're my favorite aunt and uncle, but we don't talk religion and politics with them, you know, because they were a different stripe in both categories. And I found that to be true, that we could not talk about those things. And I also found out they were Texas Longhorn fans, so I couldn't talk college football as well. But there's no way in which you can separate or divide religion and politics when you talk about the Middle East. I suppose I can preach a sermon against abortion and never bring up the subject of politics and laws before a legislature or Senate. But there's really no way you can adequately address the subject of the Middle East without seeing the entanglement of religion and politics. For one thing, Islam is a church-state religion. The church is the state, and the state is the church. So on that basis alone, you cannot separate church and religion. So let's look at question number one. Where did the Arabs and the Jews come from? Now, some would think, well, that's easy because I remember something about Ishmael and Isaac and the story of how Abraham got a little impatient with his wife, Sarah. They've been waiting around for 10 years, and Sarah's biological clock was running out. And she said to Abram, listen, honey, we hadn't had this child yet that God has promised. How can we have descendants that would be as great as the stars in the sky, as the dust on the ground, if we have no offspring? Here, take Hagar, my Egyptian handmaiden, and you produce a family through her. Now, voila, we have the story of Ishmael. Some would think that the story of the Arabs began there, but actually it does not. It begins prior to that. Look with me in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 10. Boy, it's just going to be a brief run through. But bear with me. Genesis chapter 10. In Genesis 10, we have the table of nations given by God to the writer of the book of Genesis, Moses. And what we have here in Genesis chapter 10 is exactly what Paul alluded to when he preached to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17, when he says he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. So God, in his predestination characteristics, he has preordained or pre-appointed where all the nations of the world would dwell. All the nations that we have today, all ethnic groups, derive from Genesis chapter 10. All of us descended from Adam and Eve. We're in agreement with that, right? But we're also all descended from Mr. and Mrs. Noah. After the flood, there was just Noah and his wife and his three sons. So it can also be said that we've all descended from Noah. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. If you look in verse 2 through verse 5, you will see the descendants, not all of them, but the main ones, are listed here in verses 2 through 5. For the first time in the Bible, the word Gentiles is used in verse 5. Now what we see here in Genesis 10, 2 through 5, as you look at these peoples, you will see this is a reference to the Indo-European countries. We see Germany mentioned here, Gomer. Magog is probably a reference to Russia. Javan is probably a reference to Greece. In fact, you will see in verse 3, Ashkenaz. The Ashkenazi Jews come from Germany. And so here we see the beginning of the Indo-European peoples. It is safe to say this morning that most of us who are gathered here in this room are descendants of Japheth. We're of Indo-European stock. Let's move on. Look in verse 6. He gives for us the sons of Ham. And he begins to mention those by name. Of course, we know that Noah cursed Canaan, the son of Ham. And we see in this grouping of people, descendants of Ham, we see Africa. We see the Canaanites who dwelt in Canaan before Abram made his journey there. And we saw the Jebusites, the Hittites, and those that dwelt there when Joshua came and took over the land. We see Sodom and Gomorrah mentioned as those who came from the descendants of Ham. We see Egypt being mentioned. Mizraim is a name for Egypt throughout Scripture. We see Put. We see Cush, Egypt, Ethiopia, Libya are mentioned in verse 6. So we see the African people. We also see, as it is mentioned in verse 17, the Sinite, S-I-N-I-T-E. Most genealogists will say that this is a reference to the Chinese people, the Japanese people, the Far East people. In fact, you remember the Sino-Japanese War? Siang is a very popular name in China. So here we have the African people, the people who dwelt in Palestine, the Canaanites, and we have the Far Eastern people, which, if it is true, as most people believe it is true, those are genealogists and archaeologists, and etc., that the Bering Sea land bridge, these people in the Far East then would travel over to North America and South America, the Eskimos, the Indians, the Hispanics. And so you see, we have here in the descendants of Ham, we have the African people, we have those who colonized in Canaan, and we have the Far Eastern people, and from that we get the American Indians and the Hispanic people. Okay, that is the descendants of Ham. Let's move on. He saves the best for last, because from Shem, the third son, would come the line of the Messiah. Now notice in verse 21, he mentions the descendants of Shem. Notice the name Eber in verse 21. The father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder. And then it mentions in verse 25 that Eber had two sons. One was Peleg, and the other was Joktan. Now, Eber, from that word we get the word Hebrew. In Genesis 14:13, Abram's called the Hebrew. Abram was not a Jew. Jew is a shortened form of Judah, one of the 12 tribes of Israel. But he was a Hebrew. Eber means on the other side. The Arabic word is A-B-I-R, Abir, which means to cross over, which is what Abram did. He crossed over on the other side of the Euphrates River, Ur of the Chaldees, and came into Canaan. That's Eber. He had two sons. Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, a reference to Genesis chapter 11. There was a United Nations attempt in chapter 11. All the nations came together and wanted to make a one world government to do without the need for God. And of course, we know what happened. God didn't like that. He dispersed the people. He scattered. He divided the people so they could not understand one another. He gave them the gift of tongues in reverse. So in Peleg's day, that's what transpired. That's probably the reason why Eber probably named his son Peleg, because in that time frame, that happened, the Tower of Babel, chapter 11. Now from Peleg, if you follow that along in chapter 11, verse 10 and following, you will see Abram is a descendant, a direct descendant of Peleg, one of the two sons of Eber. So that is the origin of the Jewish people, the Jewish race. He had another son, Eber did. It was Joktan. And in verse 26, he mentions their 13 sons, the 13 tribes that settled in Saudi Arabia, current Saudi Arabia. These are the 13 original colonies of the Arabic people. So what we see is that the Jewish people and the Arabic people are blood brothers. We got a family feud over there that's going on. The word Semitic comes from Shem. So originally, if you're anti-Semitic, you're anti-Arab, you're anti-Jew. Although That term anti-Semitic is a recent origin, and it refers primarily to being anti-Jew. So the first 13 tribes of the Arabs come from Joktan. And then the Jewish people are descended from Peleg. Let's move on. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 to 3, we have the call that God made to Abram. I will bless you. I will give you a great name. I'll bless those who bless you, and I'll curse those who curse you. And you, all the families of the earth, shall be blessed. And so we have the story of Abram being called out of the Ur of the Chaldees to go to a land to become a nation. God had told Eve, the Messiah would be born through you, a seed of woman will crush the head of the serpent. But now in chapter 12 and following, it's saying not just through woman will the Messiah come, but through a particular nation will this Messiah come. And so God called Abram for that purpose, so that he could build a nation through him by which all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That's the Great Commission, Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Make disciples of all nations. Okay. And so we have the story of Abram. He's 75 years old. You know, he's past retirement age. He's drawn his Social Security check. He's probably thinking that sitting in his front, you know, on his front porch in a rocker, my name's going to business. God calls him. I got a work for you to do when you're old. Okay, so don't give up when you're old, friends. God has work for you to do. So Abram goes to Canaan. Who lives in Canaan? The descendants of Ham. And there we have the story of Abram and his wife and his nephew Lot going to Canaan. Now, as I said a while ago, Sarah said, honey, it's not working out. It's been 10 years. There's no child. How in the world are we going to have a great nation if we're dead and gone? They bury us in the ground, and there's no descendants. There's no offspring. How can this be? And so Abram heeded to the voice of his wife, from which we get the birth of Ishmael. Look in chapter 16. And this is of primary importance. After Ishmael was born, or after, I should say, after Hagar conceived, and all of a sudden Sarah kind of changed her tune and said, listen, I don't like it, I'm jealous, and she has a child, I don't have a child. And Abram said, you do with her what you want to. She began to treat Hagar harshly, and she's on the run. And the Lord catches up with her. And this is the first time in Scripture, really the longest length of time, that God will have an extended conversation with a woman. Right here in Genesis chapter 16. And it says, Hagar, you return back to your mistress, you return back to Sarah, you submit to her. And the angel of the Lord in verse 11 said to her, behold, you're with child, and you shall bear a son. Are you familiar to Gabriel's word to Mary? And you should call his name Ishmael, because that word means God hears. God has heard your affliction. He's seen you. He knows all that you're going through. Because the Lord has heard your affliction. He will be a wild man. The Hebrew word for there is pere, P-R-E, which means a free-spirited person. Anybody who knows about the Arabic people know they are very free-spirited. They're very expression-oriented. You don't see very many timid or withdrawn, you know, introverted Arabic people. They're just free-spirited. It goes with the territory, being out there in the desert, in the wilderness. He'll be a man suited for his environment. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. In other words, God says, right here in Genesis 16, that Ishmael and his descendants will be in feud with one another constantly. And they will dwell in that land in the presence of the brethren. And that's true because since the beginning of Ishmael, the Arabic people in the Middle East have not been uprooted from their land. No one has truly subjugated them or controlled them. They controlled themselves. They dwelt in the presence of their brethren. That's true. Now, Ishmael is part Semitic because of Abraham. He is part Hamitic because Hagar is from Egypt. So here we see a commingling. We see that the Hamitic people, the Saudi Arabian people, the 13 original colonies of Saudi Arabia, they came from Shem. Okay. But we also see here now that Ishmael's descendants would also commingle with Ham. There's no pure bloodline among the Arabs. They're a combination of Hamitic people and Semitic people. And to complicate things even worse or more, Ishmael's daughter would marry Esau. So there's part Edomite stock in the Arabic people. But the important thing I want you to see in verse 12 is this. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. This brings us up to the Middle East. The truth of the matter is that God has promised here, and this serves as a warning when we try to take matters in our own hands and try to circumvent the will of God, like Sarah and Abraham did, and not wait upon the Lord. This is what happens. The truth of the matter is, if there were no modern nation of Israel today, the Arabic people would not get along with one another. They never have. In the Gulf War crisis, Saddam Hussein invaded what country? A fellow Arabic country, Kuwait. He had his eyes on another fellow Arabic nation, Saudi Arabia. When the PLO came to Jordan and civil war broke out among the Palestinians and the Jordanians, and the PLO was driven out, it was Arabic versus Arabic. When Iraq had her long war with Iran, it was Arabic versus Arabic. The truth of the matter is that the Arab people in the Middle East, because of what God says here in Genesis 16:12, have been at war with one another. You trace that all throughout history. And if there was no modern country of Israel today, you would still see instability and war and bloodshed in the Middle East. They don't like one another. They're suspicious of one another. When Anwar Sadat signed that peace treaty with Israel, the Camp David Accords, what was his reward for doing that? He was assassinated by a fellow Arab in his country. And even those moderate Arab leaders overseas, if there is such a thing, they're very cautious. You know, they're walking on pins and needles, because if they try to make any sort of peace with Israel, there is this intransient Arab radical fundamentalist group in their country that is quick to launch an insurrection and an assassination attempt. That's happened many times over. So what unites the Arab world in the Middle East today? What brings them together? One thing. Their hatred of Israel and those who support Israel. Now, the theme of our worship day is the love of God. I can think of a place in the world that needs to know about the love of God. Now, I don't subscribe to this guy's views, but Chekhov was a communist. Anton Chekhov. This is what he said. Love, friendship, and respect do not unite a people as much as a common hatred for something. And I'm afraid because we've adopted Henry Ford's analysis of history. He said history's bunk. Because modern America and our modern educational system has done that, We don't know what's going on over there in the Middle East can be traced back to its history, to its roots, to its origins. Because the key to understanding the present and the future is understanding the past. And we must understand that God has said here in His Word that there'll be this incessant feud. He'll be a wild man, a free-spirited man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in that land in the presence of his brethren. And because of that, we have bought the line, I'm afraid, over the last several months or so, thanks to Larry King, to Oprah Winfrey, to politicians, and to religious leaders, that Islam is a peaceful religion. It's a compassionate religion. That there's only these few nutcakes, these loose cannons out there, that's given Islam a bad name. Just like you Christians had the Crusaders back in the 11th century, you know. That there's only a few radicals out there, but Islam, if you study the Quran, you will see that it's a very compassionate God. It's a very merciful Allah they worship. And we bought that line because we don't understand the past. You see, God is not against the Arabic people because they're Arabic. The problem with the Arabic people today is because they've embraced, for the most part, a false religion. That's the problem. And by the way, most Americans have embraced a false religion. They emphasize works over grace, right? And Paul tells Timothy that there comes a day where the people will believe deceiving spirits and the doctrines of demons. Friends, I'm anti-abortion, I'm anti-smut, I'm anti-drugs, you go down the list, but I'm telling you this, more people have gone to hell because of religion than anything else. And John MacArthur had it right on his radio show. The day after September 11th, he said, friends, this is what satanic-inspired religion will do. And you must understand this, that most Arabs, not all Arabs are Muslims. Most of them are, but there are some Christian Arabs. They're being persecuted by their Arab brothers who are Muslims. Do you realize that Islam is the second largest religion in the world? In the home of John Calvin in France, it is the largest religion. There are more mosques than churches now in England. There are 6 million Jews in America. There are 10 million Muslims. In Australia, it's going at 257% rate, the increase among Muslims. And while all the people are emphasizing that it's a very compassionate religion, Caleb Julab, he's 35 years old, a native of Baghdad, Iraq. He's a seminary student at the seminary I went to. And this is what he said in a recent article. If you have a chance to study Islam and its history, you will see that it is not a peaceful religion. This is the same Islam that says if a Muslim converts to Christianity or any other religion, they will pursue him and kill him. This is the same Islam that has spread as far as east as China and as far west as Spain by the sword, not by missionary work, in the 7th and the 8th centuries. This is the same Islam where Muslim nation rises against Muslim nation, like Iraq and Iran in the 1980s, and they call it jihad. This is the same Islam that says a Muslim man can kill his wife or daughter just because he suspects them of adultery without any proof. And he can get away with it because Islam supports it. This is the same Islam that says Muslims should not befriend Christians or Jews. This is the same Islam that says Muslims must kill infidels or unbelievers. Jihad, the holy war. Now, the origins, the root causes of the Arab-Israeli conflict go back to Genesis chapters 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. with particular emphasis in Genesis chapter 10 and Genesis chapter 16. Very quickly. Number two, what are the origins of Islam? And I'm going to just totally ignore my notes. I don't have time. The 29th descendant of Ishmael is a man by the name of Muhammad. Muhammad lived in the Saudi Arabia area. At that time, most of the people, the Arabic nomads, were polytheists. They worshipped many gods. When Muhammad was about 40 years old, he was born in 570. At 610, when he was meditating in a cave, and Gabriel supposedly appeared to him and called him to be a prophet to set the record straight, because the Jews, the Christians, had diluted the message of the revelation. And as the final testament, God would reveal through Gabriel to Muhammad the final revelation of God, that there is only one God, one Allah. And by the way, Allah means moon god. There are moon gods. So this whole idea that Muslims believe in the monotheist is wrong, because most of his concepts and throughout the Quran are borrowing terminology and ideas from the polytheism in that day. And Allah means moon god. So when somebody says, well, you know, Muslims worship the same god we do, they just call it Allah. That's bunk. Okay? It's a Greek word for that. It's bunk. And the Muslim people believe that this was on par of the virgin birth of Christ, because here was Muhammad, who could not read or write, was able to receive these revelations from God through Gabriel. And he didn't write the Quran. His followers did after he died, because he could not read or write. And so he was able to receive these revelations from God over a period of about 22 years. Well, the people there in Mecca, his hometown, didn't like what they were hearing. They were polytheists. And so on July 16th, 632 AD, he went to Medina. And that was called the Hadith in Islam. It's a very holy day. And the calendar is marked not by AC, BC, but AH, after the Hadith, when he moved from Mecca to Medina. The people of Medina listened to him. They liked him. He rounded up soldiers to his cause, went back to Mecca, overtook it, and inside Mecca there's this black meteorite stone, a cubic shape, called the Kaaba. And if you will see pictures of this in periodicals, you will see that one of the pillars of Islam is that every faithful Muslim must, if he's physically capable, has the finances, return to Mecca and make the trip around the Kaaba. And when he went back to Mecca, he cleansed the Kaaba of all these polytheistic gods, and he says, truth has now been enthroned and falsehood has been dethroned. And from that moment on, through military might, he conquered the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. After him, after he died, his followers began to move toward Europe. They came to Spain in 732. And if it wasn't for Charles Martel, God providentially placed that man there, defeated the Muslims. Who knows what Europe would have become like? Muhammad believed that the Jews would accept his revelation. So at first he said, let's pray toward Jerusalem. But then, realizing that they would not accept his leadership, he began a policy of exterminating all the infidels, all the Jews, all the Christians, the people of Saturday, the people of Sunday, he would call them. And through the power of the sword, he conquered, and his followers. Now, there are five pillars of Islam. How do you become a Muslim? Well, there are five things you must do to become a faithful Muslim. Number one is this. You must have a profession of faith. It's called the Shahada. And what the Shahada is a combination of two different verses in Scripture, in the Quran. The first one is this. It says, we believe that God is one, He is Allah, and Muhammad is His prophet. Now, if you say that, you are a Muslim. You said in the presence of two witnesses, you are a Muslim. Now, the second one is this. You must make a tax, a tithe. It's 2.5%. It goes to support mosques around the world. There's a third pillar, and you must fast during Ramadan. We've heard it, you know, through the Iraqi war and throughout in Afghanistan. Man, we cannot bomb. We must respect the Islamic religion, but we cannot bomb or attack during the month of Ramadan. And that's when they fast. That's a holy month for them. In 1973, the Arabic nations attacked Israel on the day of Yom Kippur. And what happened recently in Israel, what's been called the Passover Massacre, one of the suicide or homicide bombings. It didn't stop them from bombing on a Jewish religious holiday. But Muhammad made it very clear that the topmost pillar, see, the Muslims say there's five pillars, but there's really a sixth pillar, and that's jihad. Muhammad said there is a sixth pillar. The topmost pillar is this. It is jihad. That all the forces of evil, all the infidels in the world, they must be exterminated. And so we come to the Middle East. And I love Middle East history, and you know, you can't even cover Middle East history in a semester of college, so how can I do that in 5 minutes? In the 1800s, the Russians and the either Eastern Europeans were persecuting the Jews. And so the Jewish people began to contemplate the idea of returning to a land where they could be in peace. And Theodor Herzl was an Austrian journalist, and he contacted the idea of going back to Zion, to Mount Zion, to establish their homeland. And after World War II, we realized that the Jewish people even became more aware to prevent a further Holocaust. We need a place to go to a land of our own. The Arab people at the beginning were very for the idea, because when the Jews returned to Israel, it was mostly vacant. It was desert. It was wilderness. It wasn't cultivated. There was nothing there. There were a few nomadic people there. There were Arabs who lived there. They weren't called Palestinians. They were just Arab people. The word Palestine or Palestinians is of recent origin itself, from 1967 on. And so they kind of welcomed the Jews at first, because the standard of living went up. They cultivated the area. They had crops. Wages went up. Schools were there, and everything was fine and dandy. But then, through Arabic pressure, through a whole host of events, the tension began to rise in the Middle East. And after Israel became a nation in 1948, we had the very next day, we had five Arabic nations attack Israel. And there you have Jordan, who annexed the West Bank. It's a back-shaped B, if you look on the map. And then you have the Gaza Strip being taken by Egypt. In 1967, these Arabic nations again tried to attack Israel, and it just so happened that through the Six Days War that Israel regained all these lands that was once legally theirs through the UN partition plan, through the British mandate, the French mandate after World War I, World War II. And so as one looks upon the Middle East, you think, well, it's all about land. No, it's not. Because the PLO has made it a point, and all the Arabic nations in their charters, in their constitution, that they will not be content until, and here's the phrase, until Israel be driven into the sea. Now, I know that Israel is not without guilt. They're sinners, just like Arabic people are, just like American people are, without the grace of Christ. But we must understand that the key to understanding the present is to understand the past. Can we wrap it all up? I'll be back next year, okay? What do we make of all this? What concluding remark can I make? Well, let me just say this. I don't know how it's going to turn out. And I don't think it's time or place for us to be as smart as God. Because God says nobody knows the day or the hour, right? And I know that there have been books already written that we're on the brink of Armageddon. This is World War III. Well, maybe or maybe not. And I'll let Alan teach you an eschatology, okay? But I remember a few weeks ago, I got this in the mail from CBD, Christian Book Distributors. I told my Sunday school class this. We're going through Revelation. On the last page, there's these bargain buyouts, you know. And there's some pretty good books on sale. Stepping Heavenward. We gave that to our women one year on Mother's Day. The Pilgrim's Progress. Good book. Fox's Book of Martyrs. You know, they're all on sale from $7 to $4 or $3, which is a reasonable sale. Then I saw this one book up here. Armageddon, Oil and the Middle East Crisis. Retail, $8.95. On sale for 50 cents. Now, after our Sunday school class, now you tell me why in the world, and I've seen this book in bookstores. It was written about 1990, 1991. Recall what's going on back then? Why is this book on sale for 50 cents? If you buy 10 or more, it's 25 cents a piece. Now, why, you tell me, why is this book on sale for 50 cents a piece? And one insightful lady in our class said, because what this guy wrote about would happen didn't come to pass. I said, bingo. That's why January 2000 at Mardell's in the center aisle, you saw these Y2K books marked down to $1.50 a piece. It's very foolish for us to try to be as smart as God. Friends, I'm not on the planning committee. I'm on the welcome committee. And so are you. I think we need to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. We've tried appeasement, we've tried military engagement, we've tried shuttle diplomacy, we've tried peace treaties. We've tried containment throughout history. America's tried that method of appeasement since Israel's conception, 1948. And all those methods have not worked. Maybe that's why God inspired David to say, hey, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And I pray that the residents of Jerusalem today, there's a Jewish quarter, there's an Arabic quarter, there's a Christian quarter of Jerusalem. In name only, they're Christians. I pray that Jerusalem, the earthly Jerusalem, would come to know the Prince of Peace, that they, who are Jews, who are Arabs, and those in name only Christians, might know the peace that comes from justifying faith and have their names enscrolled in the new Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, that comes down from heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. Let's pray. Lord, it's all so complicated.